Light is the left hand of darkness, and darkness the right hand of light. Two are one, life and death, lying together like lovers in Kemmer, like hands joined together, like the end and the way. Ursula K. Le Guin, The Left Hand of Darkness. Welcome, friends. I'm Ada Joy Kerman. This is first day, the second month, the second day, the year of our Lord, 2020, or in ancient Roman reckoning, Groundhog Day. The local forecast appears to be that the groundhog did not see its shadow. And I want to, can you run and grab my ledger book? I want to set...
It didn't.
Or
the spring.
Excuse me.
Sorry.
I want to locate us in time. And I've found that it's interesting. There are a number of events that people, if they were alive, usually remember. You look pretty young, so does any of you remember the end of World War II? Show of hands. About Korean War? I'm seeing about three hands there for the Korean War. So let's get to the, I bet that a lot of you remember JFK's assassination by a show of hands. I'm seeing everybody except me and Andrew have their hands raised. And so then we'll just fast forward, I think, to... the Space Shuttle Challenger explosion. Andrew, we've gotten everybody. I won't go forward from there.
Why are you marking...
I will take questions at the end.
Okay.
I am setting an intention to speak for about 60 minutes and have up to 30 minutes for questions at the end. So I was born on June 4th, 1972, about a month before the Watergate break-in, but my mother says she can alibi me. And backing up a week from that, I think I was a little overdue. My mother was ready, but I wasn't, so she went on a lot of bike rides because she had heard maybe that would help shake things loose. And also to pass the time, I believe there was a game of Risk being played. Since I am focusing on games here. But I also, a few other things that fascinate me go into this, like how I was about 6 months old when the last man walked on the moon for Apollo 17. Also, I noticed that the comic strip Doonesbury had been going for almost 2 years by the time I was born. Walt Kelly of the Pogo comic strip was still alive, and he published his strip starting before my parents were born. So as a comics fan, I find that neat. I also think that it's interesting that my least favorite Quaker president was in office when I was born. That this is such a Protestant country that I can pick whether I have a favorite Quaker president, and my Catholic friends already, they know. And, well, Richard Nixon and Herbert Hoover. And also, hearkening back to games, Herbert Hoover brings to mind Monopoly, which I've played a lot of, including Solitaire six-player Monopoly. The next thing that I think is interesting, I don't remember much about what games I played before I was five. So, suddenly, I was born in the Gerber Memorial Hospital in Fremont, Michigan, named for the Baby Food Company, which is in Fremont, Michigan, and I lived in Hesperia, and Fremont had one screen theater. Suddenly, on the radio, we're hearing da 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 da, and I went and saw Star Wars. So I think I was five. And then Carter decided that we should have registration for the draft. And my parents and I stood outside the Fremont Post Office on the public, on the sidewalk. On the sidewalk, handing out handing out pamphlets that said, "Think before you register." And a lot of parents apparently didn't want their sons to think because they hustled by. And I believe, but the adults who were there can correct me if I am wrong, that the town tried to pass an ordinance saying you couldn't do this and that on the sidewalk, and then some service groups like the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts complained because they would sell things on the sidewalk. Okay, so this is a roughly corroborated anecdote. When I was almost four, my parents said that we were going to have a new brother or sister that we were going to adopt. And they said, we've narrowed it down to, they said, we'd like you to help. Then they learned that it was going to be a little native girl. And they said, what should we name her? And I said, Ada, which was a great name. I already named my teddy bear that, but they said, no. It would be too confusing, and they gave me two choices, and I picked Hannah Rose. She likes that because she doesn't think the other one would suit her. It turned out that she would be ready to be picked up on June 4th, 1976. Right, which is, I think people were getting ready for the bicentennial, and the Fremont painted their fire hydrants to look like cool, funny little guys in red, white, and blue. And we drove south about an hour to Grand Rapids to meet my sister. And I have always said that that was the best birthday present I ever got. Mm-hmm. Speaking of games, though, I do recall that I got a fire helmet from some feminist for my birthday that day. Moving forward again, I did get a brother. In 1979, I was able to be present at his birth. I was almost seven. Mostly what I did was I played with the Richard Scarry's Best Rainy Day Activity book, which my parents cleverly got for me, but I was able to cut his umbilical cord. I believe this was a plan because I remember strength training. I was warned that sometimes they're tough, which is a good thing, given the function. So I know that I'm pretty sure he was alive when we went down, because ex utero. In Grand Rapids, Michigan, lived my mother's parents, Preston Clarence Hammer and Hilda Knight Hammer, and her younger brother, Arthur Hammer, and he was into computers. And one day we arrived for a visit, and there was this gleaming ultra-modern thing sitting on a table, and my immediate first reaction, this is a direct quote of what I thought was, can I touch it? So I think I get to the visual aid now. And while I'm getting out the right visual aid, I will also say that it was not possible to get mass market cooperative games at the time, but my parents located games published by the Animaltown Game Company and Family Pastimes. And I'm going to pass around a game called A Chicken in Every Plot by Animaltown Game Company, but my personal top favorites are Save the Whales and Dam Builders, and if you could pass that around.
Sure.
There should be a print. Can you get me that little plastic bag? Yeah. Yeah, you can take a couple moments, but not super long, and this is a Family Pastimes bag to go along. So I think that the floppy disk is in my small box. So the Apple II Plus that my uncle had a green on black monitor, but he was able to hook it up to the family TV for slightly fuzzy color vision. No, it's not in this box. We may or may not have a floppy disk here. I'm not going to bother about the 5 1/4, but not as old school as my husband was able to go because he had the 8 and a something and ran a BBS. Okay, so we will not bother about magnetic media here. We'll just say, ooh. Also, my father and I signed up and drove to Grand Rapids for a class on programming in BASIC. And
that's after you got the computer.
Okay. I was able to buy the computer used from my uncle, which I believe I did using my own funds. Maybe my parents subsidized me, but I know I chipped in and had skin in the game. Mm-hmm. And it was considered mine. So I will fast forward to when my parents decided that it was time to for my father to quit his job as the director of the Fremont Public Library and move to the Philadelphia area to study early Quaker history, because there's a lot of resources there at Swarthmore College and whatnot. And I was 11 when we moved. We lived in a succession of cheap housing on the outskirts of Philadelphia, not in the city proper. And I was homeschooling, and so I did research, and I think it was probably my mother's bright idea. We designed a series of Quaker history role-playing simulations, which are probably on one of those floppy disks somewhere in our house. I don't think we were quite able to interest any big Quaker organizations in publishing them.
That's too bad.
Well, we may be able to find them yet. They did not perish in the fire, I think. So, my parents cleverly introduced me at the annual Friends General Conference gathering of friends to somebody who worked at a weird little school called the Meeting School in Ringe, New Hampshire. Which is why I used this tote bag to bring some of my games. It's the 50th anniversary tote bag. You can feel it if you want, but I'm not going to pass it around. So I thought it was fascinating. He told stories about being a teacher at the Meeting School, and I'm like, well, I think I want to go visit it. So we arranged for me to go visit the school in probably January 1986, which segues into my thing that I did at the beginning, because I spent a weekend visiting the school. I got a strong intuition that it's where I was meant to be, and on the way home, driving back down to the Philadelphia area, on the radio I heard that a space shuttle had blown up. So that's how I heard about the Challenger explosion. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I wasn't sitting in a classroom watching a launch of the first teacher in space, because I think that would have been pretty horrific.
It was.
Were you in a classroom?
Yeah.
May I ask what grade?
You would ask that.
You don't have to answer.
Middle school.
Okay.
I don't remember which specific.
So at least old enough to have some, I don't know.
Yeah.
Probably first grade would have been really bad.
Yeah, no.
Oh, and backing up to violence, when I was in third grade, which was one of the two public school grades I chose to attend, I didn't really get it, but my teacher gave us a really freaked announcement that Ronald Reagan had been shot. So he did pull through, breaking the Tippecanoe curse. I guess I didn't care about him. I knew that everybody except my parents in the area voted for him, but they voted for MacArthur, whoever it was, the other guy. Oh, and I wasn't going to school on Mondays, and that's when they did the mock election, so Reagan won the mock election in a landslide. So, I apply, I get accepted to the Meeting School, and I enter there in ninth grade in the fall of 1986, pulling the Kerman family gradually towards New Hampshire. For ninth grade and tenth grade, I was a boarding student who commuted to the Philadelphia area for vacations. In 10th grade, my mother came up and taught winter trimester therapeutic touch and stuff. And then my parents thought it might, well, there was a job opening, and they were interested in applying to teach at the Meeting School, but first they checked with me to make sure it was okay, which it was. After, Also, for context of historical time, I will note that my first house parents were people who at the time were known as Kate Van Meter and Skip Van Meter, and they had a tiny baby named Kevin Van Meter. He was later joined with brothers Alex and then Lucas, and we'll get back to them later in the story. So Skip Van Meter was teaching a Cities of New England course probably when I was in 11th grade or something, and he arranged for us to visit various cities. One of them was Burlington, Vermont. So that's when I met Bernie Sanders. And my observations at the time were, we had some prepared interview questions because our teacher was alert like that and had us think about it. And Bernie answered some of them straight up, and other ones of them, he turned about 15 degrees off to make sure he got to his talking points. Still, I would vote for him if he gets the nomination. I think Slippery might be good against the opponent at this point. Then we had a field trip my senior year to visit some campuses of colleges. And we went to Antioch College in Yellow Springs, Ohio, and it was going on to Earlham after that. And I get out of the van, and bam, I'm supposed to be here. It's one of the clearest instances of leadings that I've had in my life. I believe that previous to this time, when I got to Antioch, I learned that campus lore was that some, not too many, but some years past, people from Antioch College called up Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and said, "Can you please change your flight paths so they're not going right over our campus?" And Wright-Patterson said, "Well, our flight paths are confidential, and anyway, they're not going over your campus." And so there was one two-floor building that had a flat roof, and some students went up there and in large letters dropped an F-bomb on Wright-Patterson. How can they call up to complain? I don't remember what the story said about whether they did or not, but I think the flight paths changed after that. It's something that I'm not going to say on tape, but it starts with an F and it ends with a K.
Oh.
It's a four-letter word.
Or if you're more familiar with George Carlin's work, I believe it's one of the seven words you can't say on television.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It's about in the middle of rudeness on that list, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. So also when I got to Antioch College, I was introduced to music by an Antioch alum who had been there about 10 years before me, and another person also from Massachusetts. Why is the world in love again? Why are we marching hand in hand? Why are the ocean levels rising up? It's a brand new record for 1990. They might be Giants' brand new album, Flood! And they said Flood because they had 17 tracks and they were kind of going against the trend for not having very many tracks on your album. It had songs like Particle Man and...
Constantinople?
Yes, Constantinople. I saw the lyrics for Particle Man posted on one student's door. I've heard it said on Usenet that it's actually describing the philosophy of Hegel, but I'm not good at philosophy, so I can't speak to that. And the reason I brought up They Might Be Giants is because this is when Apollo 18 gets into the world. They made a CD for the brand new technology of shuffling CDs, and they had a whole section on the album Apollo 18 called Fingertips of, say, 20 seconds to 1 minute. Well, anyway, there were a lot of really short tracks, so if you shuffle it, they show up anywhere in the shuffle. And it's pretty fun, but of course I was too broke to have a CD player. Fortunately, my friend Alex had my back, and he shuffled Apollo 18 and gave me a tape, so I had one shuffle of Apollo 18. And I will note that by this time, I think Alex has started the Degree Confluence Project, which you can still find at confluence.org. And I have the honor of being user ID number 2. I was a volunteer for a while, which is how I have my Confluence mug. The first consulates I visited, I didn't have a GPS yet, so I did... Okay. He got a GPS. The goal is... He was like, what can I do with my GPS? You go to a place that is the intersection of a whole latitude and longitude. He went to... He was in New Hampshire, so he went to the closest one to here. Yay! And he, I think he biked, well, maybe he biked the next time he went there. The first one I visited was when I was visiting my husband in Portland, Oregon, and I got some topological maps from a local store and triangulated it pretty well. It's just off of an interstate, so there's like a billboard that you can take a photo of right from the confluence point. But we're kind of jumping around in time. The other thing I have in my notes for college is that I had a friend, Walter Scott, who is really not Googleable, but his wife is. But anyway, he was a little older than me because he had not registered for the draft. And he thought, maybe if I don't go to college till after I'm 25, they'll have to give me financial aid. But guess what? They didn't, but somehow he found the money. And he was taking this peace studies class and complained to me one day, we're not really having any very great conversations in class. So we broke into the classroom one night with a book by Gene Sharp, and we spent a little while writing 100 positive strategies for nonviolent action all over about 4 of the chalkboards. And, nothing was locked. It wasn't hard to break in. But he said that the discussion the next day was much livelier. Also, in college, I programmed the Mandelbrot set in C++, which was fun. Okay, so it is a fractal, and I have a really rough sketch of it, which... The concept of fractals is that they're really detailed, and if you zoom in, they're still really detailed.
Yeah.
And they, if you program it to do it in color, they come up with really cool art. And it's hard to do anything with them until there's computers, because mathematicians 100 years ago considered them to be horrible abominations. but Benoit Mandelbrot called it the Aleph set, and I read his book about it. Some of the part-time jobs that I had at college were at the library, and it seemed really cool to me, so I also arranged to have a 3-month job at the library. And I applied for library school. I got a little hyper, and one of my computer professors said I could use his long distance, so I called every library school in the U.S. in the directory. And I said, is it a problem that I don't have grades? And you can tell what college was in what part of the country, because I called the West Coast, Northwest, and say, oh, are you from Reed College? And whatnot, and I ended up getting a scholarship offer, but no money. No income to State University of New York, Syracuse Information Libraries Science. Because unlike where my father went to school, they believe that librarianship is a science. My father has a Master's of Arts. And I guess I should have had a gap year because I wasn't really ready, and I think if I know how to calculate grade point averages, I think my GPA in library school was 2.0. I didn't have a way to earn money. I was scrounging. I got like 3 A's and an F the first term, and 3 F's and an A the second term, and that A was from my favorite professor, and that was indexing and abstracting. But somehow by the end of the year, I had gotten a part-time job at a library branch in the poor black part of town, Beecham Branch, teaching people how to use computers. And that seemed more interesting to me than librarianship. I remember teaching people how to email the president. One kid wrote, "Dear Mr. Clinton, thank you for being president. Our neighborhood is a lot better now." And I would teach older people how to use a mouse, you know. And I had been kind of a a stuck-up brainiac brat in high school, but by that time somehow I had learned patience, and that it's an intellectual challenge to try to communicate with someone on their level. So you're taking your brain to the next level. And I got a room. It was a dive. All the other guys who lived there were guys. One of them seemed to live in the recliner in the living room. He was the landlord's father. So I had my Mac Classic, which I had bought in college, used on the internet, and a 4800 baud dial-up modem. And I guess I had a separate phone line, because I don't remember people complaining. And I would do things like, I would go on and I would play adventures that are in text, because that's how fast the connection is. One style of adventure is called MUD, which stands for Multi-User Dungeon. And one of the places I played was called Angolan. I couldn't really get it to work on my MUD client, but I found that they have a nice map on their website. I might pass this one around, because it's important. Okay, so pass it along, please. I made friends when I would go around hunting. Jennifer's grinning because of how she met Mason. Which was, anyway, that's not my story. And one of them, his real name is Jonathan Ingram. And one day he messaged me and he said, "Hey, are you anywhere near Albany? Because I have a friend in Albany." He didn't say. He just got a job there and moved up from the south. But that's what actually happened, and that's why he messaged me. I said, "Well, kind of. It's like a 3-hour drive." He's like, "Well, you might be interested in him. He might like you. He's, you know, smart. He likes math and computers and stuff." And so every so often I'm like, "Hey, do you want to see about getting in touch with him?" And like in October, he's like, "Okay, well," he says, "you can call. Here's his phone number." No, it was 1 week before October 4th, because I called him for 3 hours. And then he's like, "Wait a second, I make more money than you. I'll call you back." So he calls me for 2 hours. And I learned later that I was very fortunate, because he had dial-up also. And that dial-up company disconnected you as a matter of policy after 6 hours. And that was right before I called him. So, we arranged to meet in person on October 4th, and he shows up. And I knew he was stout or something, but I didn't know that I was going to look down when I said hi to him, because he was my mother's height, 5'3". And we go around Syracuse. We go out for Indian, and I spill lassi on myself. And lassi is kind of like a milkshake, but not as sweet. It's made out of yogurt.
Yogurt and mango. Yeah.
Well, in the U.S., it's usually sweet or mango, but when I was in India, you could choose salt also. I sort of skipped India because there wasn't a lot about games in there. I skipped Germany and England for the same reason. So, we walked all over the place because I didn't have a car, and eventually Harold went home, and we started dating. And that was really fun, because I married him later. He was working for a company that, just to put it briefly, was rival Dilbert's fictitious company for idiocy. The shortest anecdote I have about that is that if you had a notepad with like a cardboard back so you could take notes and stuff and help your brain think, you had to turn in the cardboard back to the supply room to get a new one issued. So one day we're walking through Office Max and Harold looks at the price of a 20-pack. And he's like, "Okay, I got this." He takes the 20-pack to the office, and he puts out a sign, "Free, help yourself," on his desk. And people had to check, "Are you sure? Really?" Because they were so broken from the supply policy that they couldn't believe that they could take a 50-cent notepad from his desk and use it. So he felt like it, you know, maybe this wasn't the best place to continue his career. And they got a contract with the state of Oregon, and he sent out there for 2 weeks to do designing specifications, and I arranged to visit him on the intermediate weekend, which may have been when I went on. I might have stayed for more than a weekend. Anyway, I think that's when I visited the Confluence, and I'm not going to check the date because that would be like time wasting. But the state of Oregon had been burned before, and they said, well, we'll give you the contract if you have an on-site liaison. And Harold and I decided that we should go for it. And in 1999, we drove west. We stopped in Kansas because every other year his uncles had a get-together. The opposite year, it was like a big family reunion. So I got to meet a bunch of his uncles, including Robert, who was a Quaker minister, if I recall. And I heard some stories that they didn't say until I shut off the tape recorder that I was recording them on. And since I'm recording, I won't pass that on at the moment. We got to Oregon. We lived in a little 400-square-foot apartment on the fourth floor of a building that was half a block from the light rail station, so that was pretty good. I had some health issues, and Harold's like, well, I can get 9 days a week of leisure by the amount of money I'm pulling down doing Oracle programming, so you just take care of yourself. And there was a pretty popular game show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? At the time, you could call in and try to do the screening on the telephone. So I would sit there in the easy chair and call, and eventually they called me back. And they invited me and a guest, which was obviously Harold, to go to New York City with the travel and a per diem. And they told me what kind of clothes to pack. And Harold had never been there, so I won a trip, a little mini vacation for me and my husband. And I'm going to back up to college again, because when I was on the internet, a friend of mine showed me this story. It's like about this funny role-playing story where the players didn't know the definition of the word gazebo, and they figure their dungeon master is warning them about a monster, so they start fretting and trying to attack it and stuff. So, one of...
Fireball at it? I don't know.
Excuse me. One of the fellow contestants on that edition of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire is the author of the gazebo story. He told me that every so often he would Google Eric the Paladin, who was one of the characters, and send a cease and desist notice. But he did give permission. Knights of the Dinner Table, which is a gaming comic, had that as one of its first comics before they knew about the author. Later they credited him once they understood the situation. Neither of us won any money, but it was cool to meet him. And it was weird getting makeup. The makeup department was able to make me up very carefully to look like Ada. only under the TV lights. Also, I noticed that the set was a lot smaller than they were able to make it appear on TV. Several multiples of audience numbers. And then Harold and I saw the Statue of Liberty and maybe the Empire State Building, but the World Trade Center was boring, so we didn't go see it, but it was there, which is another hallmark time. And I'll note that almost all of the moments that I'm thinking about where you can get interesting historical perspectives involve sudden, unexpected violence. And that's what I'm getting at with that. So Harold thought it would be cool to start a gaming club. And there was this club that is run by the current owner of the license to Dungeons and Dragons, where they would send you adventures so you don't have to write them. And there's a way of tracking if you earn magic items. So you can go to different places, and it's valid that you have a +1 magic sword signed by somebody. Usually people play at home and the DM knows how they got the thing. So this is sort of...
Dungeon Master.
So Harold was like, let's start a monthly club running these living Greyhawk adventures. Greyhawk being one of the worlds provided for players by the Dungeons & Dragons publishers. And we were sitting around brainstorming what should we call it. And together we sort of came up with the name, the Clan of the Cave Nerds. I got my brother to do a logo. It's hard to tell on this t-shirt because it's older than my oldest child, but the cave nerd has an arrow, and it's brought down and slain a thing marked of Dungeons & Dragons, and there's a dice bag. And I have it up on my website, so if you want to see a better quality picture, I'll give you the link. And we found a gaming store a little ways down the highway from Portland that we would go to, and that was our local gaming store. I'm sad to say I don't remember the name right now, but... And we started doing monthly games, and one day, this woman and two sons showed up. And she was Gene Owl's daughter-in-law, and the sons were Gene Owl's grandsons, and Gene Owl is the author of The Clan of the Cave Bear. And I'm on the mic, so I won't tell you my favorite stories about gaming with them. But if you ask me about a paladin later, I'll tell you. So Harold was pretty much in charge of organizing this monthly activity, but I thought, well, there's somebody running a gaming convention in March, GameStorm, but it would be fun to run one in the fall, but maybe not on the same day as the science fiction convention, nor WestCon, because some people might want to go to that. So I organized a convention. By then we were playing a different setting from a different publisher called Arcanus. They were really good at writing stories. And so we got like a bunch of tables of people playing Arcanus, and we got some guys to come down from Vancouver and run some adventures and stuff. And that's Vancouver, BC, not the close Vancouver, Washington. And I sold t-shirts that I made on Cafe Press, and I was pregnant with someone who's currently called Caspian. And it was fun. It was kind of break even in terms of money, but we had computer programmer money, so that wasn't a big issue. Prior to being pregnant, I mean, Harold had asked, he knew before he proposed that trying for kids was a deal breaker. I mean, it was a hard line. He had to decide he was up for being a dad to propose to me. And then he's like, so we buy a house because we would rather not have a family in a 400 square foot apartment. And we could afford to. And then he's like, let's have another 6 months or something to get settled. Anyway, so we're in a house now. And we're getting gifts from our gamer friends for the kids, like plushy 8-sided dice and stuff, and stuffed elder gods, the kind of elder gods that you'd rather don't show up and notice you. And we started hosting games at home, too. We had this nice big table that was basically a big sheet of plywood on legs, which is perfect for gaming. So my friends, Skip Van Meter and somebody who wasn't Kate Van Meter anymore but had gone through two names, and Mia, were both living in Portland, but they'd separated, divorced. And Kevin and Alex and Lucas are old enough to game. There's a game that I learned about when I was at the meeting school, called, well, it was at a science museum, and the first time I saw it, it was called Civilization. And then I actually went back there while I was at the meeting school and picked up a copy for my father or something. But people have tweaked the rules, and it's Advanced Civilization now. And I think I have the rule book in here somewhere. Maybe it's in this other... Anyway, I have a picture on my tablet. We'll settle with the lightweight thing. This is a game where you need to commit yourself to it. Skip would host it over a weekend. That was about the right amount of time to play it. And so Skip and Kevin and Lucas and Alex and me would play, and maybe some other friends. And they had played it more frequently than me, so they were pretty good. I never won, but for me, gaming is about the process and being with people. So that was cool. Photos. And Harold and I hosted it at least once, because I have a picture of me and Harold and a lad who games with us, name of Quinn, playing it on that table that I mentioned. So the reason I like this game, which is of the genre where you have a big board and little tiny square counters that you move around, most of those games are war games. You're simulating like a battle in World War II or something. But this and those ones are in hexagonal grids, because every purist knows that if you try to go diagonal from a square, it's a different distance than if you go up and down. But if you move away on a hexagon, it's always the same distance. And gamers care about this type of thing. So this has a larger irregular set of spaces, and it's the ancient Mediterranean. And you could choose to play as Egypt, Crete, Italy, Africa, etc. And your goal is to advance your civilization. And Jesse didn't learn this when he was a boy. Your goal is not to go to war with your neighbors. Your goal is just to maintain enough access to resources that you can build up your resources by trade and and learn more things about how to interact with the world. So, nuanced cooperation is usually the best strategy. And we've got a game in progress right now, and what I've done is I've been taking photos so when the cat goes by and we're not playing, we can replace it. And that's why I can show you what a board looks like. But tax season started, and I didn't package it properly, so we should at least maybe finish the current round sometime. Another thing I did with the Van Meter boys was there's a role-playing system called GURPS, for General Universal Role-Playing System or something like that. And you're supposed to be able to do anything with it, but it has about 20 million books, and you pick the ones that have the flavors you want. And one of the things that fascinates me is alternate history. What if something had gone differently? There was a resource book for alternate history, so I ran a campaign of that. I'm like, okay, so in order to have our... There's like two competing presents, which are our future. So the players are time agents in a Cold War with the competing grim, dark future, trying to make sure that the happy, joyous future is the one that actually happens. And I said, okay, your mission is to go back in time and help Nikola Tesla be a little more successful. And what they ended up doing was introduce him to a bright young woman who would be his like trusted wife and business manager, so that the second half of his life was more productive. But there was a funny thing. The guys were packing, they're like, okay, I'm going to bring a GPS, this and that, and they get back, okay, I checked my GPS. I'm like, well, nothing happens. There's no satellites up there. Because we're in the 19th century.
Oops.
Moving along, after I left Portland, Christy Owl passed away, and there was a friend of Harold's that lived with us for a while in the Albany area, and I'm afraid I've forgotten his name. But as long as I can remember things, he will be dear in my heart to the first person who noticed that after I got laser surgery and lost my eyeglasses, that I had changed my personal emoticon, which is made out of little typewritten things, to not have glasses on it. And that's still the personal emoticon I use today. And I'm going to pull up the pages. Maria is going to read a eulogy in memory of my husband Harold and Christy Owl and our other friend. This is a gamer's eulogy. I think it works best in portrait mode here.
The empty chair. Eulogy for a gamer. There is an empty chair at the table this day. A hallowed place where a friend once played. The roll of his dice, my ears long to hear. Or perhaps it would suffice if he should suddenly appear. With character sheet in hand and a bag of Cheetos, cheese doodles to share, all his friends would stand as he sat in the empty chair. I hear his voice a-calling, and it ties my heart in a knot. For he cries, though a comrade has fallen, he must play for those who cannot. We conquered worlds on the run, he and I in the name of fun. And as others may come and go, I make both friend and foe.
I have a package which might be out in the hall, which is looks like a Torah scroll in cross stitch, Maria. It's
it's rolled up on the table. Is it still in the table?
It might be because it's not in here. I want that one next. Also, at this moment, I'm going to note that the traditional food of gamers is pizza and Mountain Dew, but it's okay to update traditions sometimes. And so I'm going to pass around these salted, lightly salted nuts. Allergy warning, contains nuts. And I've got the lid with it to Andrew.
Okay.
Here's the lid.
The lid could go in advance.
It's true.
Yeah.
We should do Ultimate Frisbee with it. I was on the Ultimate Frisbee team. I did play softball in college. My nerd friends invited me to join the Star Trek softball team. The uniform, I chose blue for my solid color. We had a...
science officer.
Indeed. We had a Starfleet insignia that we appliqued on, and then they whomped up something that got screen printed on the back in the Mac Klingon font, which when transliterated says, we are better than bad, we're the worst. Now, we knew this was true. When we were scheduled to play the top-ranked jocks, we had a strategy meeting. We're like, we got nothing. What if we provide them with mixed drinks, hope they're too drunk to play? So we had a whip round and we bought the mixed drinks. One of us was a bartender, but of course, they knew how to hold their liquor and they still beat us. However, my best statistic is that I got second base and I got a run batted in. Yep. Now, I also read a bunch of comics on the web, and one of them was by Scott Kurtz, and it was called PvP, for Player versus Player, but he also had a print version of it for a while, and I was showing this comic from the print version to Harold, and it's, okay, so it's like, the scene in that comic is that people work at this magazine that publishes stuff about gaming, but some of the characters are randomly, like, a troll. And stuff. So the troll is being convinced in the strip to try to paint miniatures, miniature figures that you can use to represent your character.
Why don't you go ahead and hand me the tool I got over there?
Oh, yeah. And Andrew's got some miniatures here, and he might as well show you his braille dice also. You can send the braille dice around after the miniatures.
So these are two miniatures from a variant of Dungeons & Dragons called Pathfinder. One of these is a human oracle, which is a divine spellcaster, and the other one is a dwarf some sort of meat stick. I don't know exactly what it is.
Can you define meat stick?
Oh, sorry. Basically, big, very beefy, and very strong, tends to take all the hits.
Right.
And a
bouncer.
And soak them up.
Yep.
So Harold looks at this comic strip in which the troll is being encouraged to try painting miniatures, and he points to the troll and says, "That's me." And I had a program that you can use to design cross-stitch patterns, but I decided to make him a copy of it. But I tweaked the troll to look like Harold. So here is, this one can go around slower so people can read it as it goes by.
Yeah.
I know, you want me to read it to you afterwards, or anywhere?
Sure, yeah.
Anyway, the gist of it is that the troll takes a miniature, and he takes the small green can of paint, and he dunks it in the paint thing, and he pulls it out and goes, "Sir Weston the Green." And the other guy goes, "No more miniature painting for you."
Quick question. Why are the Braille dice not... this isn't Braille numbering, is it?
Yes, it is, actually.
Oh.
So Braille is two cells, or is six cells. It's two across, three down, and so the numbers are basically the same as the first six letters of the alphabet.
So you know by context?
So that you know by context, yes. So one dot is one, two is two, three is three. But they're slightly arranged a little differently on those dice because they're supposed to actually look visually like you would look at the dots on a regular die. So it doesn't quite exactly match letter to number like Braille normally would.
And there were, like, the other set of dice was the one where you were complaining about some design features that were a little confusing, right?
Yeah. So I also have a set of traditional gamer dice here that also have, the Braille correct letter to numbers. The only problem is they were 3D printed by someone's own hobby shop. And I don't know if it was a rush order or if they're normally done in this fashion, but unfortunately some of the seams when it was put together kind of comes across and keeps me from being able to properly read one of the numbers.
Like having a big line across the page or something for sighted
people.
Yeah,
exactly. Or like if somebody tried to write a 7 and it ended up looking more like 8.
Do you think people would like it if I send this around, or would that be too busy?
And if you want to go ahead and just pull them out, look at them, as long as they
this
all get
is the
back
one
back.
Where we did Tesla. Here's your minis back. Do people want me to send around a couple of role-playing resource books, or would that be too much?
Too much.
Interested parties may browse them for a few moments after the presentation. This is the GURPS time travel adventure that I ran the Tesla adventure off of. One of the first Usenet news groups I got on when I first got on the internet, because I'm a fan of Spider Robinson's science fiction, including the Callahan's Cross Time Saloon series, was alt.callahan's. And this is a GURPS resource book to roleplay in that setting. This is the rulebook for Arcanus, which is what Harold and I was our favorite system at the time of his death.
Is that the one he wrote adventures for?
I skipped lightly over how he wrote. He wrote a bunch of adventures for that. But first we co-authored. We had fun co-authoring an adventure for Living Greyhawk involving a gnome. And I think that I'm at my most creative working with someone else to bounce ideas off of. That's one of the things I miss about him. But I see some of that at play in my children. They could, if they choose, be wonderful collaborators. And sometimes they are. I'm also going to zoom back to the 70s or 80s for a minute here, because one of the homeschooling activities we did was my mother led us in designing a game. There's a story in the Friendly Story Caravan about the value of cooperation called The Seven Kingdoms and the Hidden Spring. And I knew I didn't want to try to find the game. I don't know if it survived the fire, but we have to actually game bags to hold the game in. So we sewed them with Velcro and stuff. And I'm not sure what these pockets are for, but it's probably the cards. Yeah.
Cool. Also, it occurs to me, fun fact that I learned a couple years ago, I should share while those dice are going around. The very first version of Dungeons & Dragons, which is the main game most gamers know and cherish, started out as an actual simulation for Gary Gygax and his co-creator, I can't remember the
name
of.
Dave Arneson.
Dave Arneson. They were trying to do a war game sim, and they didn't have a way to represent the battles to the level they needed. So they just came up with grid paper and the rules and slapped it down, and it's kind of become, it just sort of evolved from there. And back in the day, they didn't have the fancy multi-sided dice that's in that bag of them I passed around. They just had the traditional D6s, so everything, that's a term meaning six-sided dice. So this is the only dice they used for the first couple of editions of Dungeons & Dragons.
And for my gamer street cred, I believe I sat in on a game of first edition Dungeons & Dragons because my mother was doing some boring adult thing like getting her teacher's certificate and meeting with her advisor, and I wandered upstairs and there were these older kids doing something interesting looking.
Was it chainmail or the actual like first Dungeons & Dragons?
It was something cool. In high school, I fooled around with Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, creating settings that we never got around to playing. So, I didn't really get into role-playing fully until I met Harold, and we would be gaming in the Greater Albany area. And I have a visual aid here somewhere, which says Paranoia on it. Paranoia is the role-playing game of a darkly humorous future in which you're in some underground bunker called Alpha Complex run by the great and almighty computer, which is the person who runs the game is the computer. That's their title instead of Game Master. And in that location, I chose for my first role-playing game to run to be Paranoia because arguing with the computer is treason. So even if you don't have the rules right, it doesn't matter. And any smart Alex can get zapped by lasers. I mean, it's so deadly
or
that
excuse me,
it's so deadly that your character comes in a 6-pack of clones. So I'll just pass this around.
Pack of what?
Clones.
Clones.
Oh, I heard clones.
So when your character dies, you don't have to stop playing right away, unless you continually fail, in which case you run out of clones and you're done.
You have to fail 6 times. So that's
this is a later edition that came out around the turn of the century, Paranoia XP.
Oh.
When my kid comes, he was a dungeon dragon.
Cool.
Dungeon master.
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah, so hopping around in time, I'm trying to avoid getting to 2008, but it's going to come soon enough. Yes, Harold wrote a bunch of adventures for Arcanus. Arcanus had some sort of regional system, and Harold got in to be one of the three people in charge of a region, and so he was writing a bunch of adventures. And and in Arcanus it's set up so it's collaborative storytelling, and if you play adventures at their premiere at the National Convention Origins, which is currently in Columbus, Ohio, all of the results of all of the times that somebody plays that adventure there dictate what actually happens in the storyline as they continue to write the story. So Harold and I were like, cool, let's go to Origins in 2009 and play at the premieres. But I came home on August 22nd, 2008, where he was working from home and he was dead. I didn't think to call the cops. I spent a while. I finally got a hold of Papa, and he said, did you call 911? I mean, there was no hope. So, it turned out to be better for me to live in New Hampshire with my parents. And they said, if you write your will, we'll watch the kids while you go to Origins. And with my permission, the charity that Arcanus chose that year was the Heart Association in memory of Harold. They did a t-shirt. You had to be keeping track of the listserv to put in to have your name on it. And I was obviously not keeping track of email, so my character's name isn't on it, but Harold's is here under Williams. I picked up my copy of the shirt that summer. His character was Sir Santosh Garagi, a gnomish bard. And in that setting, bards, their best attribute is charisma, and gnomes have a penalty to charisma because Harold wanted it to be interesting. And he was pretty good at his fighting and whatnot. And my character was Lady Helena Molotilani, who was a horse nomad with a repeating disc crossbow. And I think picked up some magic skills later. So, moving quickly towards the present, I guess. But also, going back to the 1980s, we saw this ad in Games Magazine when I was a kid for the Great Maltese Circumglobal Trophy Dash, where you go around the world on maps at your kitchen table. They're not doing that one anymore, but they have continuously been doing the St. Valentine's Day Massacre for, I don't know, a long time. I'm hoping that he doesn't retire. Anyway, so your price includes a Rand McNally Road Atlas. You go from coast to coast. Each year, one side is the Statue of Liberty and the other is the Golden Gate Bridge, and it alternates which one you start with.
Oh.
And there's rules. Okay, so we actually won a trophy, probably because there's been some attrition in the number of players over the years. But this is 24th place from 2014 in the 51st annual St. Valentine's Day Massacre. And you have to know what a quarter inch is, because that's how far away you can see. So that's why there's a ruler in here. And I'll just pass this around in case people want to look at it. Papa and I decided we pretended that we'd have enough attention to do it this winter. They sent it out on New Year's or whenever you get your money in, and it has to be in by late March-ish or early March-ish. So we're kind of behind because we're only in California still. We started in the Golden Gate Bridge. But they promised in the advertising that we're going to go through New Hampshire, so hopefully we'll get there before the deadline. What else have I got? It's a puzzle game.
It is a game. Okay. It's a game that's played on an atlas.
If you buy a shirt from Arcanus, it gives you bonuses to play. This one says, once per adventure, you may tap this shirt to reroll any failed attack roll. Now, a few words about simplicity. I'm pretty sure it was before August 2008 that I decided I didn't want to buy any clothing with words printed on it, because I had like Quaker shirts like Quakers Are Friends Here, and I had gaming shirts like it shows the cartoon character holding out his cup and it says "We'll game for food," and here's my Quaker shirt here. And so I every time I went to Quaker meeting, I'd be sure to get out a nice Quaker shirt, and when I went gaming, I'd get the gaming shirts. And then I mixed it up once because I was like, what? Why am I doing this? And that's why I eventually decided not to buy words. Although I think I forgot about that idea when I got excited about working at H&R Block and I bought a ball cap and a warm coat. It's not old because it has a URL on it. The oldest kinds don't have URLs on them. Yeah. So that was my first simplicity thing that I want to say about. And also, Harold's co-workers had a whip round and gave me some money when he died. And our cell phone company was going to be the first company that was let you have a smartphone that wasn't an Apple. So that fall I bought an Android smartphone. And I forget exactly when, but about 5 years later I gave up on smartphones. I wore them as long as I could to get a Quaker reference. I didn't like how I was using it.
It wasn't 5 years.
You don't think it was 5 years? I kept breaking them. I broke at least 3 or 4 of them. So it was at least 1 or 2 years.
Yeah,
we'll do it if you can't manage it.
If you straighten the bag, it'll have the most room. There we go.
Yeah, so I think... So that's my witness. No smartphones for myself, and do not buy clothing with printed words. Robert checked with me, because there was this fundraising thing that's still going on that started in October, Team Trees, where a YouTuber was challenged to raise $20 million to plant trees to celebrate his 20 millionth subscriber, in case you care, it's Mr. Beast. And they researched it. He was challenged in the spring. They decided that Arbor Day Foundation would be a good organization to work with. And they rigged it so that if you buy a shirt with Team Trees on it, all the money goes to plant trees, so they must be paying for the shirts. So Robert checked with me if it was okay to get it for me for Christmas. But furthermore, it would have been a gift, so it would have followed my rules anyway. But it does mean that I think that 35 trees are going to be planted because of that shirt. It's not that cheap. and I'm going to wear it for casual day on April 15th. Also, my children have invented about conservatively 100 games since they were born. So that's just a note. And I have taken them to Origins, but also the life insurance money ran out and it was kind of a long trip. And so our current practice has been to go to TotalCon, which is in the Boston metro area in February, time for the Massachusetts vacation week. And so that's a little break during tax season where I can reaffirm my connection with my kids. And, last year we played Advanced Civilization on Thursday, except Robert, Robert went off and did his own thing, and there's this LARP, usually there's a...
So live action role-playing, was what that
means. Right. Sunday afternoon, there's a guy who's skilled in running live action stuff, and they take over the breakfast restaurant, and so we're going down there in February. But Robert loves Origins, so I promise that next year we're going to Origins, by inshallah. And we go by train, because I kind of haven't done planes because of my carbon footprint for some years. It's tricky for Columbus. You have to take the train to Cleveland and then the bus to Columbus, and you arrive in the early morning and you go to your hotel room. So I've probably roughly hit my 60-minute mark, and we're roughly at the present day, so are there any questions?
Could you tell people a little bit about the, I feel like there was a kind of almost ministry that you and Harold had with younger people who were role-playing at your house?
Well, sure, because Harold was the kind of guy who would always give them a ride home, even if it was 12:30 a.m. and he had to be at work the next morning. And we'd, have food and stuff, and one of them moved in with me for a while after he died. And I kind of let him live in the house for a while until I realized that it was time to commit to New Hampshire. I just got a couple of phone calls for him in January. I'm like, he hasn't used this number for 10 years. Oh, sorry, I'll take you off the list. He contacted me on Facebook a while ago. He said, I've been contemplating my life, and I'd like to go visit Harold's grave. I'm like, sorry, he's in an urn on top of our bookshelf, surrounded by a pile of games. Harold did the right thing. It was cool hearing at his memorial service how that manifested at work. And he had the grace to be married to me for more than 10 years. I'm getting full Social Security. So, between me and the kids, our share has actually, if I had been a little better at money, covered our living expenses. I've been able to spend a lot of time with them. And so, thanks to that wily old cripple FDR, who made sure that it wasn't means tested and even the rich people would get their Social Security. It's amazing how long it's lasted. Do people want another pass around on the nuts? Here, I'll just keep the lid this time, right? Okay. I trust you.
Well, I think we had a good solution for the lid
last time. Well, sure, and we could try Ultimate Frisbee. Yeah. I remember one time my coach, actually Skip Meter, was telling everybody what they were doing wrong, and I'm like, Skip, can you tell me what I'm doing right? He said, well, you're good at staying open because people know that you're a horrible player, so they don't guard you. And it actually worked pretty well sometimes. I think we might have beat high mowing. That was way back before the Frisbee company got after them, and we still called it Ultimate Frisbee instead of just Ultimate. And I will say that I have now completed successfully seeing every Star Wars movie in the theater, original release, including the digital remasterings, and now Disney will just have to try to woo me in for additional ones. I've done my mission.
I had a question.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys know this, and I'll give background too, but so you mentioned that they were only using six-sided dice in the earliest stuff, like when Chainmail transitioned into being Dungeons & Dragons.
Yep.
And I hadn't actually been aware of that. I had that weird insight recently. I was wondering how many six-sided dice were they using for dice?
That I don't know, because I haven't been able to find a set of rules that I can read myself.
Okay.
Because
they usually do scans.
The game doesn't give this away to you. I'm legally blind, so.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried looking a little bit, but not. I will admit I've been a little busy with other things. I just had a move recently. I honestly didn't know that they had a full edition for that, because I thought they were still in the sim mode. So what little I found, I'm not sure. My guess would be somewhere in the range of maybe 3 to 6, since they use six-siders for everything.
The context is I had this kind of mind-blowing revelation that with 2 six-sided dice you can actually do better percentages than you can with percentile dice, because you can actually represent 0. Roll 2 six-sided dice and you go 2 to 12, subtract 2 and you have 0 to 10.
Nice.
As opposed to 1 to 10.
What's
so
percentile
then? Percentile is like, if you want to say you have a 30% chance of falling off this cliff when something, you know, startles you. And so you roll 10-sided dice and that will give you a percentage back. But the percentage that you get back isn't, you're not able to actually go from 0 to 100, you have to approximate because it's a 10-sided die. So you can go like 1 to 10 or 0 to 9.
Well, actually, they've done, I don't know when they started introducing this, and it wasn't that bad that it's been around. They have created actual percentile dice sometime in the last several years. So it's 2 10-sided dice. One is the tens digit, and the other one is the ones digit.
Well, that's been going on since last century.
Okay.
Yeah, but that's still, you can't have 100 or 000 on the same range. Think about it.
So anyway, that's an interesting segue, because there was a gamer who I think is still alive, but I haven't kept track, named Mr. Zucky, who invented a 100-sided die, the Zucky die. It's not great because it tends to keep rolling. But I did buy this hex grid overlay from him, which you can place on an actual regular map to do your wargaming. If anybody wants to see it, I bought it from him at Origins. And I found this while I was digging around, too.
That's really cool.
This says, burned into the back of this cribbage board, Happy Birthday, Leland, -36. And then it says something about Ned on it, and it was in a Kerman Family Artifacts box, I think. Or it was in the mixed gaming pieces box.
It's cribbage?
Yeah.
Cool.
This was in the mail. I want to stick it in here.
Oh. The errata?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Well, maybe this was my grandfather.
That was my hypothesis. How old was he in 36, if we hypothesize 1930s? So maybe he gave it to somebody that, excuse me. On the back of the cribbage board it says, Happy Birthday, Leland, 36. It was in a tote in the study. In the tote of mixed game pieces, I believe. Yeah, the Bliss children are kindly sorting them or something. They're interacting with them.
It.
Yeah, that's fine. That's what I kind of pictured. Yeah. Also, since I tried to keep this brief, I didn't even touch on Lego, Tinker Toy, electric trains, which were kind of a side note at in my life. Okay, that does take us to England. On our trip to England, my kid brother Jesse brought his pocket money and bought Lego for much cheaper than you get them in the U.S. because it was a lot closer to Denmark.
Mm-hmm. You got a huge
pirate thing, I think.
Ship, and then he left it on the bus.
I left my rainbow scarf that's in my passport on the train in England. Mm-hmm. By this time, he had, I think, won a Lego contest in Peterborough. At the game store that was there at the time. So, I know that people are saying, oh my gosh, there's an existential crisis and we must make sure that we do not reach the tipping point and turn the Earth into Venus. But what I've noticed is my theme is that games are about connecting with real, actual other people. I know that some of the gamers I game with in Portland probably voted for Trump later, but there's still human contact, even if you're doing it online, because people tried to figure out how to play online, and so you like have computer programs and you type to each other or you voice chat once. That was once we got faster internet. That's still human contact. I saw a gaming store in the Lebanon area that said board and card games, screen time break. That's the modern marketing message.
Was that Black Moon by any chance?
I don't recall. I just buzzed by it. But it was cool driving around Hanover because, flashback to my Apple II computer that you program in BASIC, it has the historical marker there on this site in 1962. The BASIC programming language was created by, and it named the two math professors. I found an image. You can find an image of it online. It's a trivial exercise for the student. Mama, speaking of math professors, would you mind telling us what your father's policy was when his students found errors when he was writing stuff on the board?
I think he gave him extra credit. Yeah. He thought it was important for them to keep an eye on him.
Okay. So, let's see. I did have something I was going to close with. I have not read yet the latest Future Crunch newsletter, so I'm going to skim it and read a few selected good news items for you. This is a team of people from Australia, and I try not to read too much news, and this is a good anthology. Okay, so from the section, let's see. They're in a different format than usual. Utah has become the 19th and most conservative state in the U.S. to ban conversion therapy for minors. Germany is converting 62 military bases west of the old Iron Curtain into nature reserves for eagles, woodpeckers, bats, and beetles.
Nice.
HIV infections in the U.K. have plummeted since 2012, especially for gay/bisexual men, falling by 71% due to pre-exposure prophylaxis. And China's birth rate has fallen to its lowest level since 1949. It is now below that of England and Wales. There's a lot more, but I just thought I'd do a few excerpts, and we can close with a few more moments of silence. Copyright 2020 by Ada Kerman. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you very much.
And if I can just make sure I get those dice back that was in the bag I passed around when folks are done.
I thought I put them back. Oh, no, that's...
I didn't get the other bag.
Oh, right. And I didn't even pass around the game that Jackie recommended to me, Unable, Unwilling, in which you're trying to dodge being nominated for positions in a small Quaker meeting.
Yeah.
I'm not sure yet how fun it would be for non-Quakers. Maybe Andrew can tell me sometime.
Sure. If you send me something to look at.
Well,
here's a little trick of the 10-sided die thing, though.
Yeah.
Okay. So each die, and I know the ones that you need, they have actually like 10, 20, 30 printed on one of them. But each of those has 10 sides, and then